Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, today we are going to begin with a Florida man story.
Ooh, good.
Nothing like a Florida man who discovers an ancient beast of unstoppable power. All right, so the story begins in the mild late autumn on a Florida beach. It was November 30th, 1896, and there were two boys who went out for a bicycle ride along the beach on Anastasia Island, which is a barrier island on the Atlantic coast of Florida.
I believe I've been to Anastasia Island.
Oh, really?
I think so.
Yeah? How was it?
I seem to recall it being fine, if I am in fact remembering correctly. If I've been there, it was great.
Did you sense any apocalyptic power lurking below the waves?
Probably, but that's just generally how I encounter the ocean.
Yeah. The apocalyptic power is inside you.
If you're not thinking about the apocalyptic powers of the ocean, when you stare at the ocean, you're just not looking at it right. I mean, it's the ocean, man.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that will be a theme of today's episode, I believe. So tell me if this matches your experience.
Okay.
I think generally based on, I was looking at photos, the beaches on Anastasia Island look like that kind of low, flat, wide beaches with white sands.
Oh, yeah.
Not very rocky, not very steep, you know, just kind of like the beach plain.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so while the two boys were out bicycling along the shore about 12 miles south of the city of St. Augustine, they came across something tremendous and sickening. It was a giant monster blob, like some kind of enormous partially deflated balloon of organic matter stranded on the beach and half sunken into the sand under its own weight. Now, at the longest dimension, this blob was over 20 feet. It looked sort of pear-shaped, like a pear-shaped monster deep into decomposition. One end, which many witnesses took to be the head, was bulbous and solid and engorged, while the other end terminated in this asymmetrical base containing a number of mutilated rubbery stumps trailing off in some kind of frayed fibrous tissue. And the frayed stumps were described by some observers as tentacles or arms.
Very nice. Far more Lovecraftian than most of my beach vacations.
Yeah, there's nothing more disappointing than like digging around in the sand at a beach and thinking you have discovered at like some kind of monstrous shell, but you pull it up and it's actually just like an old shampoo bottle. So the boys went back to town to tell about their discovery. They conveyed the news about the blob monster on the beach to a local physician, an amateur naturalist named Dr. DeWitt Webb, who was president of the St. Augustine Scientific Society. And pretty much immediately, Dr. Webb came on scene to investigate. And eventually, more precise dimensions were drawn up. So the mass was 21 feet long, 7 feet wide, about 4.5 feet tall when it was dug out of the pit it had sunken into. And it was estimated to weigh about 7 tons. And despite its blobby appearance, I have read anecdotes. I'm not quite as sure if these are true, but anecdotes from the scene that people reportedly tried hacking at the remains with an axe and were unable to make a dent in it this way. So while it looks very blobby, it was supposedly very tough. And this giant mass in the sand with its blob head and mutilated arm stumps came to be known as the St. Augustine Monster. Now, of course, the first order of business was to move the dead monster. So DeWitt arranged a team of horses and men with ropes to dig the mass up out of the sand and drag it up the shore to higher ground, away from the reach of high tide. And then once it was safe from being dragged back out to sea, DeWitt set about contacting the experts because, you see, DeWitt had a theory. This was the decomposed head of a gigantic octopus, never before cataloged by science. For centuries, mariners had sometimes recounted stories of octopuses so big they appeared more like land masses or groups of islands than fish, so huge they could wrap their tentacles around the hulls of ships and crack them like a melon and drag them down into the deep. And this giant killer octopus of legend was known by lots of names, like the Sea Devil, the Sea Mischief, I like that one, or most famously as one of the forms imagined for the mythical beast of Norse lore called the Kraken.
Oh, yes. And of course, there also have been gigantic and semi-gigantic octopuses in Japanese folklore and myth. There's an important one in Maori folklore as well. Mm-hmm.
I think it's there's a giant tentacled creature of some kind in like Ainu, or I guess that's the Japanese folklore.
Yeah.
I don't know why the movies put it in Greek myth, because I've never heard of it in Greek myth unless I'm missing something.
It's become just immersed in there, just kind of stuck in Greek mythology thanks to, I guess, Clash of the Titans, right?
Right. I mean, I guess the idea of a giant octopus that can wreck ships is just so cool. Mm-hmm. You can't resist putting it into whatever kind of mythology you're talking about. In fact, did you know that a giant octopus was one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence?
Oh, that's how all those signatures, right? You need a lot of arms.
So there have been many different and mutually incompatible descriptions of the Kraken. But one of the most famous comes from Erika Pontoppidan, the Bishop of Bergen, in his Natural History of Norway in the 1750s, who writes that it is, quote, the largest sea monster in the world, round, flat, and full of arms or branches. And Robert and I were talking about this before we came on. Apparently, this poem, I'm sorry to find out, has already been featured on the podcast sometime in years past. But Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote a fantastic poem called The Kraken, which was published in 1830. And it's so good, it would be a shame not to read for you again.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Below the thunders of the upper deep, far, far beneath in the abysmal sea, his ancient, dreamless, uninvaded sleep, the Kraken sleepeth. Faintest sunlights flee about his shadowy sides. Above him swell huge sponges of millennial growth and height, and far away into the sickly light from many a wondrous grot and secret cell, unnumbered and enormous polypi winnow with giant arms the slumbering green.
There hath he lain for ages and will lie, battening upon huge sea worms in his sleep, until the latter fire shall heat the deep. Then once by man and angels to be seen, in roaring he shall rise and on the surface die.
I love the idea here that when it comes up into the light, it dies. Like as soon as it enters our world, it is immediately and automatically destroyed. And I think we should keep that in mind as a metaphor for the subject of today's episode.
Yeah. I mean, when we've discussed creatures of the deep in the past, that is part of the scenario, right? Things that survive in the lightless, high-pressure depths. You drag them up, they're not going to necessarily retain anything like their original form.
Right. And I think you could also say the same happens to the imagination or the myths of sea monsters once you grab them and get a hold of them to take a look. Mm-hmm. Because while I think we will make a case later in the episode that in a qualified sense, sea monsters really do exist, they often don't match exactly what people tell tales of.
Exactly.
But anyway, to come back to the St. Augustine monster, what if these legends of a monstrous octopus had been based on a real giant octopus that had never before been confirmed to exist but had been seen by the Norse mariners of old? One might have felt justified wondering if maybe this 7-ton blob with its hacked-up arm stumps on a Florida beach was the rotten head of a beast that had once been like the Kraken when it was alive. And so one of the people that DeWitt contacted about the St. Augustine monster was the Yale University zoologist Addison Emery Verrill. And initially, based on photos and a few descriptions, Verrill was convinced by the idea that this was some new and previously unknown species of humongous octopus monster. Verrill even suggested a scientific name, Octopus giganteus.
Well, that's a good name. It's to the point.
Could have been more creative, actually.
Yeah. Like Octopus Krakanus, that would have been good.
Octopus Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Octopus Bloboculus. So based on the initial photos and descriptions that Verrill received and by comparing the analogy of, you know, the size of known octopuses, Verrill wrote at the time, quote, "When living, it must have had enormous arms, each one 100 feet or more in length, each as thick as the mast of a large vessel, and armed with hundreds of saucer-shaped suckers, the largest of which would have been at least a foot in diameter."
And of course, that description instantly brings to mind some of these classic woodcut illustrations of an enormous octopus wrapping its arms around the masts of ships.
Yeah, and these match like the old sailors' legends mm-hmm. from, say, Norway or from Greenland, where they'd say, you know, if you go out in the ocean at the wrong time of year, a kraken can come up and drag your ship down.
Now, there's an older episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind I want to mention where we talked about sea monsters, particularly and how they relate to maps. We talked at length on that episode about a book by Chet Van Duzer. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he pointed out in that book is that there was very often like a political advantage in pointing out the potential for sea monsters in certain areas. Like, oh, you don't want to go on this trade route. You might get attacked by an octopus. Also, that's our trade route, and we would prefer to have full command of it.
A genius way to establish fishing rights.
Yeah, it's just one of the things here is that monsters do serve various purposes. Mm-hmm. We often discuss it on this show that monsters are a way to explain something, to perhaps explain something you have found washed up on a beach, or to explain something that is less tangible, some fear in the mind. But also, they can serve political purposes as well.
Absolutely. Now, this is a pretty amazing thing to conclude, right? In 1897, you've got real physical evidence of a giant octopus from seafarers' legends.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it was not to be because once Verrill got more data to work with, he quickly went back on the idea that this was a giant octopus or an octopus of any kind. He wrote an article in The American Naturalist in 1897, which is the year after the monster was discovered, including a lot of interesting observations about the mass. For instance, even 3 months after its initial discovery, the monster had not shown noticeable advance of decomposition. Instead, Verrill said that it had resisted decay and stayed pretty much as it was when it was first found. That's kind of interesting. Verrill also said that he had initially been misled by incorrect descriptions of the mass, including a report from a Mr. Wilson that a 36-foot-long arm had been found attached to the part of the monster, to one part of the monster and buried alongside it. And this turned out to be untrue. But the real death of the huge octopus hypothesis was when Verrill received some samples of the tissue from DeWitt. And according to Verrill, even a quick glance at these sections of the blob would tell you they were not octopus tissue. And I'll just read a section of his description with some abridgments. Quote, They are white and so tough that it is hard to cut them, even with a razor, and yet they are somewhat flexible and elastic. The fibers are much interlaced in all directions and are of all sizes, up to the size of coarse twine and small cords. Naturally, most of the interior parts had decomposed long before it was opened, so that we lack details on the interior structure. Externally, there is but little trace of cuticle. The surface is close-grained and somewhat rough, with occasional gray patches of what may be remnants of the outer skin, much altered by decay. The thick masses contain a slight amount of oil and smell like rancid whale oil, but they sink quickly in water owing to their great density. And later he says, its toughness and elasticity remind one of the properties of thick vulcanized rubber.
And here we're getting closer to the truth.
Right. So Verrill concluded, based on his experience with marine animal tissues, that it was the integument, meaning the tough outer skin, from the head of a dead sperm whale, though possibly a sick or unusually shaped one. But this amazing monster, this astonishing evidence of the great king octopus battened upon huge sea worms until the latter fire heated the deep, you know, he turned out to be nothing but a multi-ton blob of dead, partially decomposed skin and bits of other tissue from a sperm whale.
And it's crazy how that can be a disappointing answer, you know, to say, actually, it's not the flesh of an undersea giant. It's the flesh of an even larger undersea giant, just one that we're more familiar with.
Exactly. I mean, the sperm whale is a sea monster.
Yeah.
I mean, there is clearly reason to believe that some sea monster legends are based on observations of actual animals, and they're not monsters. They're animals we know about that are amazing, gigantic, fascinating, strange, terrifying creatures in their own right. And the sperm whale is absolutely one of these.
Yeah, creatures that still retain many of their mysteries. It's not even like we have a full understanding of these creatures and, you know, can see them at a zoo or something or an aquarium. The great whales are enigmas in many respects. I mean, they are beautiful, holy, blameless creatures, but they're not giant octopuses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can blame them for anything, you can blame them once dead for inspiring a lot of back and forth about new types of giant octopuses or monsters discovered. Because despite a highly reputable zoologist solving the mystery of the St. Augustine monster within a year of its discovery, right? This was 18 mm-hmm. – this is within less than a year of the thing being found. Despite this, the giant octopus theory persisted for a long time. I mean, a really long time, and not just in the halls of cryptid mania, but in respectable mainstream publications. It still gets brought up when people talk about blobs washed ashore in recent years, the idea that maybe this was a giant octopus in St. Augustine, and they figured out what it actually was less than a year later.
Yeah. So this is going to be the subject of this episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind and the following, a two-part look at globsters.
Now, we'll define globster more rigorously as we go on in this episode, but you might be able to guess already what it is. Basically, it is a blob of life washed ashore on a beach that gives rise to many questions and speculation.
Yeah, mysterious, rancid goo.
Mm-hmm. but yeah, you might be wondering, how could there be two episodes worth of stuff to talk about? It has wonderful connections to sea monster legends, to really interesting science. This turned out to be a very rich topic, no pun intended, about the richness of whale blubber.
Yeah, it has legs, even if globsters themselves don't really have appendages anymore.
Or if the only limbs they have are the hacked up frayed arms, and
right.
Those are good enough.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think we should take a quick break, and when we come back, we will go a little bit further into discussing what is a globster.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back. So this is the sort of thing we see pop up here and there. You know, anywhere the natural world touches human civilization, and quite often inexpert biological assessments occur of what remains.
Oh, yeah. I love a good goo.
Yeah, and in many cases, too, we're going to be looking at situations where it is an expert who is passing judgment on the globster or the strange jelly that's washed up, but they might not be an expert in, say, marine biology. They might be an expert in another area. So it's not just, local buffoons marching drunkenly up and down the coast and encountering strange remains.
Well, remember from the story that we started with the St. Augustine monster, Addison Emery Verrill himself, this noted zoologist, he at first thought it was a giant octopus of shipwrecking size. It was only once he had the samples in front of him and better photographs to look at and stuff that he realized, like, oh, no, I've made a big mistake.
So a couple of other examples of similar scenarios that I want to discuss here. First of all, the idea of star jelly. I've talked about this on the show before. It's one of my favorite examples, and not just because it so closely mirrors the opening of the classic films, The Blob from 1958 and the remake in 88, in which a hobo pokes a meteorite and an ooze inside of it climbs up the stick or down the stick and consumes his hand. In these cases, though, with star jelly, what you have is an amateur sees a shooting star, in the sky and then attempts to find it, to find the resulting meteorite. And so they go kicking around the woods, paying attention to stuff that they normally wouldn't deal with or encounter and certainly wouldn't analyze. And finally, they happen across some glob of fungi or decaying organic material, and they become convinced that this is what fell to Earth. This is the star jelly.
I wonder what's the funniest substance ever believed to be star jelly. Like, was there ever just like a pile of bear vomit that became star jelly?
Or candy, you know, like some sort of gummy candy, perhaps.
Oh, like a bag of marshmallows left out in the rain.
Yeah. Or a cake left out in the rain. Who knows? Now, another example that comes to mind, sewer blobs, such as the Cameron Village sewer blob in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Lovely.
You might remember this one, Joe. This one was something of a YouTube celebrity back in 2009. You don't remember this?
No.
Oh, I remember. I remember like blogging for How Stuff Works at the time, and I think Marshall Brain did some blog posts about this particular sewer blob. Because what happened is you had this gross footage emerge of a pulsating glob in the sewers. And the footage scored just a lot of blob and unknown organism headlines, but it all turned out to be a colony of tubifex worms, aka sludge worms or sewer worms. And they're just a tubified segmented worm species that naturally reside in lakes and rivers, gobbling up bacteria. But they can survive on very little oxygen and have a knack for thriving in heavily polluted areas full of organic material.
Wonderful.
So a sewer is totally their jam.
So what brought them to Raleigh? Do we know?
It's not particularly Raleigh. It's just the sewer system there. You know, there that they just have a knack for thriving inside of the artificial parameters of a human sewage system,
mm-hmm.
and then they just end up in these big pulsating masses.
So there could be sewer worm blobs all over the place. There just happened to be one that went viral in 2009.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, what's the alchemy for becoming a YouTube superstar?
Right.
A lot of it's just luck.
Right place, right time.
Yeah. This was the glob that was destined for superstardom.
This is the blobby pie.
Yeah. Sadly, this was a few years before Pizza Rat. So the sewer blob and Pizza Rat did not get to like team up in a buddy cop film. But you know, I still hold out hope for the future. But coming back to the oceanic variety of mysterious blobs, the crazy thing is you still see these headlines all the time. Heck, just this month in 2019, The Sun, the fabulous bastion of journalistic integrity, mm-hmm. They gave us this headline: mystery sea creature dubbed Donald Trump's hairpiece leaves experts stumped after a yellow blob is spotted off Australia.
Okay. Who dubbed it that? The author of this article, or
that comes to us from The Sun. Weirdly enough,
I mean, I admit that's a good headline.
Yeah. And weirdly enough, Fox News ran an article in December of 2018 listing some of the more noteworthy globsters to wash up on shores just in 2018.
I mean, there's always a blob here or there that'll get somebody's attention, and there'll be an article about it. Who knows? In the Daily Mail, maybe saying it's an alien.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to make a headline, right? Because you get to say mysterious blob, globster, what have you, has washed up on the shore. You want to see that picture, and then you're intrigued by the mystery. And the selected entries are in that Fox News piece, for example, it's a good sampling of the sort of strange blobs that are often reported. Unidentified whole or partial sea jellies or jellyfish, slabs of decaying whale and weird fish remains, and sometimes it is actually the remains of a cephalopod, or seems to be, including the odd remains of a giant squid. For instance, there was a noteworthy giant squid that washed up in August of 2018 on the coast of New Zealand, mm-hmm. like undeniably just a whole giant squid. And you see pictures of the two gentlemen who found it like laying next to it and posing with it.
Wait, do you know if it was giant squid or colossal squid?
Oh, it was our friend Archie, for sure.
Yeah, Architeuthis.
Yeah.
I think just because I think of the colossal squid as being the one in the Southern Ocean, but I guess there are giant squid down there too.
Now, the term globster itself emerges in 1962 from a similar part of the world with the Tasmanian globster.
Uh-huh.
This was a 20-foot unidentified carcass that washed ashore in western Tasmania. And this is a quote from that particular story. Scottish biologist and writer Ivan T. Sanderson coined this term globster in covering the story. And it beat out sea santa, which was a term used by another journalist covering the story as being like the term that would remain part of the cryptozoological lexicon.
Sea Santa? Where does that come?
It doesn't make sense to me.
Because it jiggles like a bowl full of jelly?
I guess. It's just a bad headline. Globster is clearly the way to go. Now, Sanderson was also a sci-fi writer. He wrote about nature, travel, and the paranormal. He's most remembered today as being something of a cryptozoologist.
Okay.
But the article he wrote included this description. It was initially covered with fine hair. There were 5 or 6 gill-like hairless slits on each side of the four parts. There were 4 large hanging lobes in the front, and between the center pair was a smooth gullet-like orifice. The margin of the hind part had cushion-like protuberances, and each of these carried a single row of spines, sharp and hard, about as thick as a pencil and quill-like. It had a resilient flesh which appeared to be composed of numerous tendon-like threads welded together in a fatty substance. So that sounds a lot like the St. Augustine monster in many respects.
Very much. Kind of fatty, kind of fibrous, mm-hmm. blob-like with like hairs or weird little frayed fibery bits that are hard to identify. Yeah, it would It would not be surprising to discover that this had come from almost anything, right? You know, like you when you see an object like this, it's just not obvious that this is clearly one thing or another.
Right.
And to be fair, I mean, again, think about the mysteries of the sea. Under the curtain of the deep, there lie great, great things probably still to be discovered. And so this is one of the things that I think sometimes people do. It sort of annoys me is like, mocking ancient peoples for believing in sea monsters, mm-hmm. because it is true that many ancient encyclopedists and bestiarists and seagoers described creatures which probably never existed. But I would posit that the belief in sea monsters generally, especially in the ancient world and even up until, recent centuries, was a completely reasonable and valid thing to believe. And in many cases, sea monsters did exist. We just now have more accurate descriptions of them and we call them by different names. The sperm whale, the blue whale, the giant squid, the sunfish, the lion's mane jellyfish. So like if an ancient sailor from Phoenicia or somewhere tells you there's a monster of the deep with 10 arms, taller than the height of 7 men, with eyes bigger than your head, he would essentially be telling the truth about a giant squid, though now we have more accurate ways of documenting these creatures when we encounter them, and we've certainly narrowed the list of giant sea creatures that we think are likely to actually exist. But some sea monsters do exist. They're just animals, and the ocean is full of amazing, rare, huge, terrifying, fascinating creatures, and sometimes even before modern marine zoology and documentaries like Blue Planet, people would come across them somehow. And one of the ways that people have long been encountering sea monsters like this is in the form much like the St. Augustine monster, washed ashore or pulled up on a line or in a net, dead, decomposing, suggesting an original form in a sort of once or twice removed fashion, like melted, alienated, blob-like.
Yeah, and ultimately like partially exploded.
Yeah.
by virtue of being pulled out of the depths.
Yeah. Not to mention, you mentioned exploded. Exploding whales are a whole other thing.
Oh, yeah.
We could talk about sometime.
Yeah, I think it's very useful, though, to think about how sea monsters were discussed in olden days. For instance, St. Augustine wrote that a monster is ultimately part of God's plan and an adornment of the universe that can also teach us about the dangers of sin. Mm-hmm. But again, a part of God's plan, a part of the natural world. So these were not described as being demons per se. They were just creatures that we did not know much about and were noteworthy for some of their attributes. Mm-hmm. 13th century theologian Thomas of Contemporary devoted one book entirely to sea monsters and another to fish of the sea. And the dividing line between the two, rarity and size, that is what determined a sea monster. Is it extremely rare and or is it particularly enormous?
I mean, those would also be things that would tend to describe top predators.
Yeah.
There are not nearly as many of them and they tend to be bigger.
Chet Van Duzer, who I referenced earlier, he brought this up in the excellent Sea Monsters on Medieval and Renaissance Maps. And in that book, he chose to define sea monsters as, quote, aquatic creatures thought astonishing and exotic in classical, medieval, or Renaissance times.
Mm-hmm.
And that covers a lot of ground, considering how little was known about the ocean depths in those times and the creatures that lived there. And as we've covered on the show before, it's always worth stressing how much remains for us to understand today, even if we can safely rule out the number of true giants that remain.
Yeah, so I would say that when the sea gives up some kind of mysterious mass, I think it is okay to have the impulse to be amazed by it and wonder what it is. I mean, it's not unreasonable to say this could be evidence of something very weird and interesting. But you also shouldn't jump to the conclusion that now you've discovered a gigantic octopus.
That's the thing, and this is one of the crucial errors that you see over and over again, right, is what is this more likely to be? Is it more likely to be a creature that there has never been hard evidence for that we do not know to actually exist? Mm-hmm. Or is this perhaps the remains or part of the remains of something that we do know to exist? Now, one of those possibilities is certainly more exciting than the others. Who doesn't want to be the first person to discover proof of some amazing beast? I mean, if you find some sort of rotting primate in your backyard, I know I want it to be Bigfoot as opposed to just somebody's pet chimpanzee that escaped and met its tragic end in my backyard. But one of those is far more likely to be the case than the other.
Well, one of them you're going to be far more likely to sell for a big score of money than the other.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't know what a dead chimpanzee goes for on the local black market, but probably not as much as Bigfoot in a cooler.
I wonder what is the highest price a supposed Bigfoot in a frozen block of ice has ever sold for.
I don't know. Probably a pretty penny.
So I think we should try to define globsters a little bit more to get a more rigorous idea of what we're talking about to fit into this category. So a lot of somewhat different looking things have been classified as globsters. What do all of them have in common? I'll posit a list of some universal criteria. This is my universal globster checklist.
Okay.
Number one, comes from the sea.
Obviously.
Number two, appears to be organic in nature. Mm-hmm. Number three, but does not currently appear to be alive. And number four, defies initial classification. So it's definitely a globster when the sea gives up some dead organism, and it's at least initially hard to tell what kind of organism it is. But beyond that, there are some other major features common to many but not all things called globsters. One is that usually the object is large, like multi-ton. Mm-hmm. Usually it looks really gross or unusual and makes people think they've discovered a new species or a monster or an abnormally large specimen of a known species like a gigantic octopus.
Occasionally bright colors come up, especially if the specimen is something that is related to a sea jelly. Mm-hmm. But certainly not in these cases where it is ultimately part of a whale.
Yeah, I'd say the most common physical description is big old blob, horrible odor, off-white, gray, or pale pink color, blob-like shape, no apparent skeleton or bones, no apparent eyes, no apparent head, covered in fine hairs or stringy substances, and a kind of rubbery texture. Did I just see you shiver, Robert?
Yeah, I did. It's just that description, right? It's just so loathsome to imagine.
I'm surprised. I usually think of you as a person who has a quite strong constitution with regards to gross and icky things.
I don't know. The sea will offer up some things to challenge us, that's for sure. So let's talk about some other examples of globsters because there are many, and we are not going to be able to cover them all today. I mean, to mention a point already made, just in 2018, you had multiple examples of globsters popping up, washing ashore for humans to find. So let's see. Let's go through them here. We've talked about the Tasmanian globster here, OG globster from 1960. Mm-hmm. There's also the Bermuda blob from 1988. Which was described as 2.5 to 3 feet thick, very white and fibrous, with five arms or legs, rather like a disfigured star. It had no bones, cartilage, visible openings, or odor.
Hmm.
This one was probably the remains of a whale carcass, by the way. Another one is the Hebrides Islands globster from 1990. And there's a description of this one that's included in a paper that we came back to several times in researching this, How to Tell a Sea Monster, Molecular Discrimination of Large Marine Animals of the North Atlantic, published in the Biological Bulletin in 2002 by Carr et al. Quote, it had what appeared to be a head at one end, a curved back, and seemed to be covered with eaten away flesh or even a furry skin, and was 12 feet long, and it had all these shapes like fins along its back.
Now, there was a Nantucket blob that was supposedly, it was like a big blubbery looking thing. There was a Newfoundland blob?
Yeah, this was in St. Bernard's Fortune Bay, and I used to live in Newfoundland, so I'm pretty sure I've been to this this area. I never saw anything like this, but Newfoundland, you do see all sorts of interesting things wash up on the shore. Described as an enormous rotting whitish mass, 5.6 meters long and 5 meters wide, no head, no tail, all bleached tissue, rough, fringed with material that looked like hair but was actually, quote, a braided tissue mixed with seaweed and sand, 7 or 8 lobes or slits. And this is from that Carr et al. Paper. The state of the decay here made identification impossible, but morphology ruled out a giant squid and suggested either the remains of a basking shark or any of several whale species found in the surrounding Newfoundland waters. Carr et al. Ruled that based on genetic sequences that they were able to determine from a sample of the remains, it is without doubt the remains of a sperm whale.
Yeah, familiar story by this point. Now, in 2003, a 12-meter-wide, 13-ton specimen of glorious blobbiness washed up on the coast of Chile at a place called Los Muermos Beach. And according to a BBC News article on the specimen from July of 2003, researchers in Santiago thought that at first it might be some new species of giant octopus or squid. James Mead, a zoologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, disagreed, telling the BBC, quote, I don't have enough data to say it's an octopus or it's a whale, but I would hazard a bet that when it gets firmly identified, it'll be a whale. And I've got a photo of it here. It looks – what does it look like, Robert?
I mean, it looks like a giant eldritch glob of a creature. Certainly, you don't look at it and think, oh, well, that's part of a whale.
No, it looks kind of like – it could be a Cthulhu head.
Yeah.
It's sort of got things that look like arms or tentacles. And that comes through based on the photos because in the BBC article, another whale expert disagrees with Mead, saying that based on the photos, it doesn't look like whale tissue. It lacks a distinctive collagen matrix. And then after that, the article goes full Kraken.
Huh.
Quote, European zoologists, and the author does not say who, it just says, European zoologists said it closely resembled descriptions of a bizarre specimen found in Florida in 1896 that was named Octopus giganteus, which has confounded experts ever since. Seems odd to me that the BBC is still floating, no pun intended, the gigantic octopus explanation in 2003.
Yeah, especially when you look at all these cases, the ones we've looked at in some of the stuff we're about to discuss in a bit here, it seems like the whale explanation is generally the safe bet.
Yeah, I mean, because remember, Verrill, the expert at the time, positively identified. He said, look, I've seen what these samples are like. This is conclusively sperm whale tissue. That was back in 1897. And over 100 years later, like 106 years later, mm-hmm. we're still like, I think maybe this was a giant octopus that was on the beach in Florida. But you know what? We can do the lab work. That's a wonderful, glorious capability we have now. You mentioned the lab results with a couple of these other blobs. So what was the Chilean blob that people are saying is maybe a new giant octopus? Well, there was a paper published in the Biological Bulletin in 2004 by Pierce, Massey, Curtis, Smith, Olivaria, and Maugel. And this was called Microscopic Biochemical and Molecular Characteristics of the Chilean Blob and a Comparison with the Remains of Other Sea Monsters, : nothing but whales. So you can guess where this one's going. They used electron microscopy to reveal that the Chilean blob was, quote, largely composed of an acellular fibrous network reminiscent of the collagen fiber network in whale blubber. They also used DNA analysis to determine that the blob was a 100% match for the DNA of sperm whales. Quote, these results unequivocally demonstrate that the Chilean blob is the almost completely decomposed remains of the blubber layer of a sperm whale. And in fact, the authors point out that despite lingering cryptozoological interest, every single one of the globsters we mentioned in the list a minute ago, or I think all of them, if not all of them, most of them are mentioned in this list, and the St. Augustine monster that we started by talking about, have also been shown by modern sample analysis to have been the decomposed remains of whales, usually sperm whales, but definitely whales. So far, it's all whales.
All right. Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about whale flesh. And we're going to discuss why and how whale flesh ends up masquerading as strange, unexplained creatures from the deep.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
All right, we're back. So we've got all these stories of a blob, a globster, a big mass of some kind washing up on a beach somewhere, getting pulled up by a trawler, appearing somewhere from the depths, looking like a Cthulhu head or a giant octopus, a kraken, some kind of squid creature, and always so far turning out to be part of a dead whale.
Yeah, because here's the deal. If you're looking for a sea monster, whales are it.
Yeah, kind
of. And likewise, if a giant hunk of something formerly living washes up on the shore, you have to at least consider that it stems from some of the largest denizens of the sea. And indeed, that classification of animal that includes not only the largest animals alive today, but the largest animals that have ever lived.
Yeah.
The larger adult whales, as we've discussed in the show before, are largely untouchable in the natural world. Modern whales, yeah, they have to contend with human ships, pollution, and they've had to survive the horrors of the whaling industry in the past. And in some cases, they do have to contend with the orca, the wolves of the sea.
Yeah, pods of orcas will sometimes try to prey on sperm whales.
Yeah, and then, of course, the younger whales are even more vulnerable in some cases. But for the vast majority of their marine peers, the whales are just gods beyond their touch, at least until they die. That's when whale fall occurs, when the whale has finally given up the ghost and it sinks. And it serves as an immense bounty, a pop-up ecosystem of nutrients in an ocean desert, sustaining everything from sharks to far more specialized whale ghouls like the bone ossidex that we've discussed in the show before.
It's the rotten Thanksgiving of the ocean.
It is. And then, of course, certainly there are cases where whales are beached. We have an entire episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind from the past about this topic, on this topic, about how this occurs. And or their cadavers will wash ashore, more or less whole. I think we've—
In a recognizable form.
Right. Yeah. Like they're, if you've ever watched any of the David Attenborough nature specials, you've seen some of these, either dealing with a whale fall with a whale corpse on the bottom of the sea and looking at all the things that tear into it, or— like bears munching on a whale that's washed up.
Wow.
You know, it is a bounty of resources. It's like this thing that was untouchable for so long and grows to such an enormous size is suddenly up for grabs. It's like the emperor has died and now the gates are undefended and everyone can just storm in and have as much gold as they want. And, but then, of course, we do have cases where we just get a big old hunk of blubber. Just a big old hunk of blubber washing up on the shore, and then people wonder what this might be. Mm-hmm. So to really put that together, though, to understand like what's going on here, we have to talk about what blubber is and what it is not. Blubber is essentially, and I really want to tag essentially here, a thick layer of fat. But it's thicker than any fat layer you'll find elsewhere in the animal kingdom. It covers the entire body of animals such as seals, whales, and walruses, except for their fins, flippers, and flukes. It has three key roles: energy storage, insulation, and buoyancy. That last one is key, of course, to our discussions here. So gnawed or hewn from the sinking leviathan, it may float free. And as far as thickness goes, because some of these globsters, they do look very thick, the thickest blubber is found on right whales who live in chilly Arctic and Antarctic waters. And it's more than a foot thick. However, the chemical properties of the blubber actually determine all three properties of the blubber. Again, the energy storage, the insulation, the buoyancy, rather than just pure thickness. So, it's important to think about that as being just part of the entire animal's outer layer. And that's how you can get some of these large pieces. You know, it's like a big flayed hunk of blubber. It's not like just a, it's not necessarily like just a single isolated part of the anatomy. Mm-hmm. And not only is this blubber thicker than the fat of land animals, it also contains a lot more blood vessels. And many marine biologists actually consider it more of a unique connective tissue unto itself.
Yeah. Well, it's got that collagen matrix that we've seen the experts talking about.
Exactly. So yeah, there are aspects to the blubber that make it rather unique. And these attributes are one of the reasons it'll end up washing ashore, but it's also one of the reasons that we may look at it and we don't associate it with, say, the fat on a butchered cow or pig or what have you. However, this does make me wonder if during the days, like the peak of the whaling industry, would you be far less likely to encounter a globster sighting just because more people would have familiarity with the anatomy of whales? Or perhaps they were, because there are fewer of them to wash up on the shore. I don't know.
That's a good point. Like people would be familiar with whaling all around, and or maybe not everywhere, but could look at that and say, yeah, that's the gold of the sea right there.
Yeah. Or indeed, would a whaler or former whaler be less likely to make the globster mistake? Would they be in a position to say, oh, well, that's clearly a big old hunk of blubber. I've seen blubber before. But then again, familiarity with the living or, recently butchered animal is not necessarily the same as being familiar with its more decayed appearance.
That's true. there is an estrangement of form that comes about after the creature has died, and who knows how far that estrangement goes. Now, I think one of the takeaways from today's episode is that it seems like the majority of these globsters, these big blobs that wash ashore and are hard to identify, are at parts of whale bodies.
Right.
But there is a whole other category of globsters that do not fit this and either could not be identified as conclusively as whale tissue or are very likely something else. And that is what we're going to focus on in the next episode.
In the meantime, while you're waiting for Globsters Part 2 or Invasion of the Globsters, whatever we end up calling the episodes, you can check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's our mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the show going back to the very beginning. You'll find links out to our various social media accounts. You'll find a lovely little tab to go check out our merchandise store where you can get a sticker, a shirt, a throw pillow, you name it, with our logo on it or something related to a past episode, such as that cool design, the squirrels are not what they seem, that sort of thing. It's a cool way to support the show. But if you want to support our show without spending a dime, just rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. And be sure to subscribe to our new show, Invention.
That's right. Don't just check out our other podcast, Invention. Click that subscribe button. That's what really matters. Do it. Press the button. Subscribe. Anyway, big thanks to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you'd like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.